prizes. And let me repeat that this set of two talks is completely independent of what I said yesterday at the departmental colloquium. So, I've been asked to give two talks on the subject of A-team ability, so let me start with basic definition. So let me start as if we were in a harmonic analysis conference. So let's be locally compact. Sigma compact group. And take pi, a unitary representation. Hilbert space. And we need two notions about the representation pi. So we state that as a definition. First, we say that pi is C0 if all coefficients function vanish at infinity. And this means exactly the following, that whenever you pick two vectors, psi and eta, in the Hilbert space, and you form the coefficient function pi of g psi scalar product with eta. So this way, as a function of g, you get a bounded continuous function on the group, and it may or may not vanish at infinity. And if all of them vanish at infinity of the group, so remember that the group is locally compact, so we know what it means to go to infinity. So it means going to infinity in the sense of the Alexandrov compactification, one point compactification. So if this limit is zero, then we say that the representation is C0. So that's one thing. The other thing is that pi almost has invariant vectors. And the notation for that is that pi weakly contains the trivial representation. So that's like that. And if you can find the sequence psi n in the Hilbert space, and these are unit vectors, and this psi n are less and less moved by larger and larger compact subsets in the group. And let me express this as follows. When you take the sequence of coefficients, corresponding to this vector psi n, this is the same psi. This sequence of functions goes to one uniformly on compact subsets. Converges to one uniformly on compact subsets. Okay. So let me give you immediately some examples. First, for every group G, we may denote by lambda G the left regular representation on L2 of G. So the group is acting by left multiplication on itself, and we extend this on functions. We get a representation
and on L2 with respect to the Haag measure, of course. And this representation, lambda g, is always c0. And why is that? Well, the reason is that if you pick two functions, psi and eta, which are continuous with compact support, then the associated coefficient is itself compact support. Indeed, you have the support of psi, the support of eta, and when you push the support of psi by the left regular representation, eventually they become disjoint. And when the support are disjoint, the scalar product is zero. So that function has compact support. But now you remember that CC of G is dense in L2 of G. So by a classical argument in three epsilons, you prove that all coefficient functions vanish at infinity. So using density of CC of G in L2 of G, you get that lambda G is C0. So that's one of the main examples. And another example of, an example of weak containment is the regular representation for an amenable group. So, and actually this is one of the many characterizations of amenability. So lambda G weakly contains a trivial representation if and only if G is amenable. And this is due to Reiter in the early 60s. And okay, suppose that you have a representation like the regular for an amenable group. So if pi is both C0 and has almost invariant vectors, and if you take the sequence psi n as in the definition, so a sequence of almost invariant vectors, then you have the following. That if you take the scalar product and pass to the limit first on n and then on g, you get 1. And if you do it in the other direction, you get 0. If you pass first on the limit of g, because this representation of C0, that limit is 0, and then you go to the limit of n. So this is exactly what students do not like in the first year, right? And this is what we are talking about. Is it to say that this is basically a talk on analysis? Okay, so now about examples. Definition. We said that G is ET amenable or has the Haag group property.
if G admits a representation phi, which is C0 and almost has invariant vectors. So, we are looking at the class of groups for which there exists precisely a representation satisfying both of the properties in the definition above. And okay, so what are examples?
Oh yeah.
Well, here is the first criterion, which I'm not going to prove. And G is AT modulo if and only if G admits an affine isometric action on a Hilbert space which is metrically, let me denote it by alpha, I guess, which is metrically proper. So, here, for this new characterization, I'm looking at the Hilbert space just as a metric space. And so when I talk about isometries, these are not necessarily linear isometries, translations are allowed. But anyway, we let the group act by isometries on Hilbert space, and there is an extra condition of being metrically proper, and this means exactly that orbits go to infinity when you go to infinity in the group. So this means that the limit for g going to infinity of alpha g v, this is plus infinity for every v in the Hilbert space. And it turns out that these two characterizations are equivalent. And having this, we are able to give the first examples. From the definition, we see that amenable groups are amenable. Because of what we said for on the left regular representation. And from the second characterization, actually, well, there are baby Hilbert spaces which are Euclidean spaces, right? And so if you take a finite dimensional Euclidean space, and this condition of being metrically proper means just amounts to being proper in the classical sense. And there is a famous theorem by Bieberbach back in the early 20th century, 1910, which tells you basically that G acts properly isometrically properly on Euclidean space EN if and only if up to a compact kernel G is a closed subgroup of the motion group O n plus R n.
And so in particular for, well, here you have ZN, you have RN, you have crystallographic groups. And this gives you the false impression that you understand the class. Well, you do understand it in finite dimension. But the example of amenable groups already shows you that if we move to infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, we get a class of, we get really interesting affine actions on the Hilbert space. And one of the purpose of these talks is to give examples of such action. But also notice that here, all the groups you get here are amenable, right? So, what else? Yeah, I think we also need to have examples of groups which are not in this class. And let me introduce for that purpose the so-called relative property T. So let X be a closed subset of G. We say that the pair Gx has relative property T if the following equivalent conditions are satisfied. First, for every unitary representation pi of G, if pi weakly almost has invariant vectors, I should give a name to the almost invariant vectors. So if pi almost has invariant vectors with a sequence psi n of almost invariant vectors, so this means that this sequence of scalar products goes to one uniformly on a compact subset. But relative property T means that when you restrict the sequence to X, to the subset, convergence to one will be uniform. So it converges to one uniformly on X. And you see that as soon as X is non-compact, this is a non-trivial condition. And this is also equivalent to the fact that for every alpha affine isometric action on a Hilbert space, if you restrict the orbits to your subset X, they are bounded. So alpha of X has bounded orbits. Is it clear what I mean by that?
Well, okay, maybe let me add.
So i.e., from every point V in the Hilbert space, the set of alpha G V, where G runs in X, is bounded.
Okay.
Examples of these situations were provided by Kajdan in 67, Margulis 73, well, and later on there were lots of other examples, but these were the two initial ones, and they are already quite interesting. So, take the semidirect product of SL2R acting linearly on R square, and then take the normal subgroup R square, and take the discrete version, SL2Z semidirect Z square with respect to Z square. So these are pairs with relative key.
And something which should be clear when we confront the two definitions is that if G is A2 Monroe and if we take a subset X such that the pair GX has relative T, then X is compact. Because in the definition of relativity, the first characterization, suppose that I have this convergence uniformly on a non-compact subset. Well, this prevents my representation from being C0, because I have this convergence to 1 uniformly. Remember from calculus 1, when you have uniform convergence, you may permute the limits, right? So that if you have uniform convergence, this representation on a non-compact subset, this representation certainly is not C0. So this contradicts the atomability. Right. So this is why I felt allowed to write that this is clear. This explains the pun due to Gromov of atomability. Gromov explains this by saying that these are groups which are close to being amenable and far from being property key. You are supposed to laugh here. All right. Questions so far?
Do you insist on the fact that X is not necessarily a subgroup?
Yes. Yeah. Yves Cornelier in his thesis convinced me that this is really, this is completely relevant. So he has a thick paper in the Annales of the École Normale where he gives examples of this situation where X cannot be taken as a subgroup.
In this first section, let me end with a lemma which I'm not going to prove. And His lemma was first stated by Ekman and Walter back in 1981, and then it was revisited by Jesse Peterson. Last year, and to the effect that, well, let G be accountable discretely. And then what the lemma says is that there are two things which are equivalent. The first is that G is not AT movable. And the second says that whenever you take phi n, a sequence of positive definite functions on G, converging pointwise to 1.
Oh boy.
Then there exists a subsequence nk and an infinite set, an infinite subset x in G, such that when you take the functions corresponding to that subsequence and restrict to x, then the convergence is uniform. So I'm mentioning this because this is as far as you can get in, I mean, as I said, I try to oppose AT manability and relative property T. So this means that, so this lemma makes official the fact that if you have a group which is not AT manable, you have some phenomenon which is similar to relative T. Well, of course, you cannot expect something as strong as relative T, but what this says is that whenever you go to the constant one with coefficients of representations, then this convergence is uniform on some infinite subset and at the price of passing to a subsequence. And the point is that for relative T, the subset X is fixed, while here it will depend on the choice of the sequence phi n. Okay.
So this lemma applies for non-discrete groups?
Not now. Now the point is that in the proof, they use an enumeration of the group. So, yeah. Well, not now. So, now let me discuss briefly why people have interest in that. So there are basically two reasons. The first is a deep result by Hickson and Kasparov, 7, which tells you that if G is atenable, and here, and G can be, doesn't need to be discrete here, so G is locally compact, semi-compact. So if G is atenable, then the strong form of the Baumkuhn conjecture holds for G. And the strong form means the so-called conjecture with coefficients. Namely, that's a conjecture which computes the K-theory of reduced cross products A is a sister algebra on which G acts by automorphism, and so you form the cross product. And what Baumkuhn tells you is how to compute the K theory of that guy. And so, if the group is atenable, Ikson and Kasparov prove that this conjecture holds true. So that's one fact, and the other fact is a theorem due to Hagerup. G discrete, Hagerup property for G is equivalent to some approximation property, which I'm not going to state exactly precisely, of the von Neumann algebra. And of you. So, as you probably know, in the last 10 years there have been dramatic progresses in the how to classify and how to distinguish von Neumann algebras associated to discrete groups, yes? And the Hagerup property was one of the first invariants exploited to distinguish algebras from one from the other. Section will be how to construct examples.
Okay.
So I will describe a very general procedure to construct examples of groups with a Hagerup property, and I mean, this example will enable us to prove, for instance, that free groups are atenable, that fundamental groups of hyperbolic manifolds are atenable, and I mean, lots of examples. But I need some notation. Take two subsets A and B of a common set X. I say that A cuts B, and the notation is this. If A meets B and meets the complement of B. So
means exactly that. I've been educated with the so-called new math, and so we did lots of drawing of this type. It's a good that it's true.
You too.
Well, we are the same
potatoes.
We
call them potatoes.
We call them potatoes. Yeah.
And we had special tools to draw ellipses, because my teacher said that if it's not an ellipse, it's not a set.
He understood everything. Anyway.
So, let X be a set, all right, so an ellipse. So what we call a measured wall structure on X is a Radon measure U on the locally compact space 2 to the x minus empty set and x.
So, such that, but okay, let me explain first here. The power set of x, 2 to the x, I can view as a compact space with the Tikhonov topology, the product topology, right? So that's compact. And from that compact set, I take away two subsets, the empty subset and the full subset. So in terms of characteristic function, this means I take away the zero function and the one function. And so I get something which is locally compact, right? And the Radon measure, it's a measure on this locally compact space, such that whenever you pick two points in X, and suppose they are distinct, the following quantity, d mu of xy, which is just the measure of the set of subsets which cut the pair xy. So I'm looking at the subset separating x from y. So x is in A and y is in A complement or the reverse. And I take the measure of this peculiar family of subsets, and this should be fine.
Okay, I will immediately give examples, but before giving examples, let me remark that this function of two variables, d sub mu, is a pseudo metric in the sense that, well, it's clearly symmetric and it satisfies the triangle inequality. Because, I think it's clear, if you give yourself 3 points,
and look at how a set can separate x from y, and put z, and well, look at the two. I mean, there are two cases. Either z is in the set or not, and this gives you this quantity and that quantity. So it's a pseudometric, and this is crucial to give to create some geometric intuition behind that. And okay, at this point, let me give example. For example one. Let X be the vertex set of a tree. And let me define a half tree as the vertex set of a connected component of a tree minus an edge. So indeed, suppose that you have a tree and you remove an edge. Because it's a tree, you get exactly two connected components, and this gives you two half trees. So when there is one here and there is one there. Okay? All right. And for a subset in the power set minus the empty set and the whole set, define mu of A will as one half times the number of half trees contained in A. And
sorry, I'm not quite sure what is the definition of that he gave.
Yeah.
I have the feeling that there is something wrong. So maybe the definition that A plus B that you wanted was the converse, that B meets both A and the complement of A. I mean, what you want is that
I want A to separate X from Y.
Exactly.
Either X or Y belong to A, not to both. That's what you mean.
No, but
so you want that pair XY means both A and the complement of A.
Yes.
So it's XY which means both A and the complement of A. It's vice versa. It's XY plus A.
Hold on. A cuts.
XY means both A and A complement.
I feel I'm too close to the blackboard.
Between the definition of A plus B, what you want is that
X and Y,
one of them is both A and the complement of A and not vice versa. So,
B.
C inter B au lieu de A inter B. C'est non, à droite.
Yes.
Vous êtes
ici. Like that?
Yes.
Il n'est pas bien, c'est une belle cut.
No, okay. I want that when I hear X must be in A and Y in A complement or conversely. Or vice versa. So, I mean, is that you happy with that?
No, I'm happy.
Okay.
It's hard to rotate this.
I think that the measure I'm trying to define here can be described in a more compact way as 1/2 sum of the delta functions corresponding to half trees. And now, let us compute, well, okay, let us check that this is indeed a measured wall structure. And you see that basically to compute d mu of xy, we must count the number of half trees separating x from y. But a half trees are basically associated with edges with by the very definition. So what we do really is counting the number of edges which separate x from y. And so we get just the number of edges on the path from x to y, because we are on a tree. Count it twice, because there are two, because half trees come in pair, which explains the factor 1/2. What I'm saying is that du of xy is exactly the combinatorial distance on the tree. Example 2. So let us generalize from trees to K0 cube complexes. So let X be the set of vertices of cubical K0 complex. And then we have this notion of hyperplane and half space that Pierre-Emmanuel explained yesterday. So, and we have this result by Sagir that hyperplane disconnects the complex into exactly two connected components, and hence this gives a notion of half space. So to every hyperplane gives rise to two half spaces, and again, for you may define a measure mu on the power set by exactly the same formula, namely 1/2 sum over half spaces of Dirac mass at H. And then when you compute the wall distance from x to y, this gives you exactly the number of hyperplanes that you have to cross when you move from x to y on the one skeleton of your cube complex. So let me write this as d1 of xy, and this is the combinatorial distance from x to y on the one skeleton of the complex.
example 3, let x be real hyperbolic n space, so Hn, and the group of isometries as a Lie group, it's something like ON1 acts transitively on the set of open half spaces. So here what I'm saying is that hyperbolic geometry, let's say the Ball model, gives us naturally the notion of hyperplane, and because we are in real geometry, a hyperplane disconnects the space into two connected components, and these are open half spaces. And they are acted upon by the group of isometries, and the action is transitive. Not only is transitive, but there is an invariant measure. So there is an invariant measure on the set of open half spaces, and the point is that when you take two points in hyperbolic space x and y, and you look at the set of hyperplanes or the set of open half spaces separating them, this set is relatively compact. Relatively compact in the space of all open half spaces. So, okay, I'm not saying that it's obvious, but at least in dimension 2, which is the first case to look at, this can be explained, because you see, fix two points, x and y, and look at all geodesics separating them. A geodesic is determined, as we know, by its two endpoints. And you see that if we look at all possible geodesics separating x from y, the two endpoints will span two arcs on the circle at infinity, and this is something which is relatively compact. I mean, the two points will not come together, which would prevent them from being relatively compact. It will not happen. And so that's the reason. And because this set is relatively compact, it has finite measure. There's finite measure for this measure M. And then we're going to jack up this measure M into a measure wall structure. So for A, a Borel subset of 2 to the x minus phi x, we set mu of A as 1/2 of the measure of the set of half spaces separating x from y.
This is rubbish.
M of the set of half spaces contained in capital A. Yeah, that makes sense. And the point is that now, when we look at subsets separating x from y, so this means we are looking at half spaces separating x from y and measure them, there is a classical formula in integral geometry known as the Crofton formula. Which tells you that this measure up to a constant depending on the normalization is exactly hyperbolic distance. So what constant formula tells you that in real hyperbolic geometry, how to measure the distance between two points? Well, you drop hyperplanes, and you measure the set of hyperplanes separating your two points, and that is distance.
So, I mean, I'm trying to remind you of Buffon's needle. Anyway, okay, maybe let me end with the definition. So, of course, we would like to let groups act on measurable structure. So, definition. Let X, U be a measured wall structure. A group G acts on X mu if first G does X on X and the measure mu is G prime. And we say that the G action is proper if whenever we pick a base point in X, we have that the limit for G going to infinity of d mu gx naught x naught is plus infinity. So this is the idea, is that the idea that orbits go to infinity in the wall metric. Okay, well, I think that my time is over, so I will stop here.
But if you need two minutes.
I'm afraid that I need more than, I mean, that I need 5 minutes. So, well, yeah,
but postpone it.
Yeah, since I'm still there this afternoon, so I guess the best is to stop here. Thank you.
Maybe after the second floor. Mm-hmm. Okay, let us thank the speaker.